This is the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, with Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kuharski on 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, online edleysbbq.com. Download the Edley's app for their three locations, 12 Southeast Nashville, Sylvan Park. And you can see their delicious menu options. Yes, they deliver. Delivery options available at edleysbbq.com. Coming up at 10:15, Stephen Godfrey of Banner Society. As we look ahead to the SEC weekend, we'll hear from Titans head coach Mike Vrabel at 11. Taylor Lewan on the show at 11:15. And Clay Travis at 11:30. A jam-packed show with some big topics throughout.
Speaking of SEC weekend, this is conference kickoff week on 104.5 The Zone, where we get you ready for the return of SEC football. You can listen the rest of the week as we highlight all the teams in the SEC with exclusive content, interviews, and giveaways. For more info on conference kickoff week, visit 104.5thezone.com. I'm pumped about Edley's Barbecue at Sylvan Park tomorrow. We can also tease this out. We're going to announce it at 9 a.m., but we have a special offer to entice the first two people to join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. when the doors open at Edley's, and you can have the full menu or their breakfast tacos they're offering tomorrow. And we'll announce that at 9 a.m. tomorrow. So something special in line for our first two listeners that show up at 10 a.m. and come say hi to us tomorrow at Edley's Barbecue.
Looking have you guys seen the photo of the breakfast taco?
I have.
Oh, that
looks delicious.
Oh, yes. We'll be having some.
To me what the thing is for the first two people.
I cannot.
Come on.
Everyone's going to know. I'll tell you during the break, Paul. Everyone's going to know at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Okay. It's a chance to lose to me in cornhole because we'll have the Midday 180 cornhole
out
there.
What a game. Bring your dad out.
Either way, if you show up, you can come and lose to me in cornhole.
Bring your dad out. He could beat people all 4 hours.
This is Tom's show.
Tom will just be beating people at cornhole for 4 hours.
I can't wait for tomorrow. It's going to be fun. I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
Tom Withrow doesn't even hit the board. He just sinks it. It goes straight through.
Old Eagle Eye Tom. It's amazing.
Hand eye sports.
Anything like horseshoes, cornhole, darts. Pretty good at ping pong. Not great.
At beer pong.
So this is a Withrow family thing. I don't know how many families play this at barbecues and family get-togethers. We're big bocce ball players.
Oh, bocce is great.
So we love bocce. And my dad is great at bocce ball also. And he's a good bowler. But I do this big, like, flop shot with the bocce ball where I try to land it and not let it bounce much. Backspin. I'm trying to throw it with backspin and, like, let it bounce once or come back. He does, like, a bowling routine. I don't know how he does it over uneven ground, but it's amazing to watch Tom Withrow with his bowling attempt with bocce, and somehow he hits the right divots.
He knows
every
the earth.
Single time and just gets it right up next to the ball.
He knows the earth. It's a man who knows the lay of the land, literally.
The lay of the land. It's his years in the Navy. Taught him the lay of the land.
He also knows the sea.
He knows the sea and land, yes.
I like that.
615-737-1045, our number. You can jump in, talk Vols football, Titans football. Paul, a game the Titans should win. As I go and watch and read coverage of the Vikings, they're going to empty the barrel. But based on the way they've been playing from the jump, the Titans are a much better football team right now.
I agree entirely. Look, if they lose, it's not a trap game. I hate this trap game idea. They're not overlooking Minnesota. The potential to lose here is that Minnesota is a desperate, desperate
team. They wake up.
And that could wake up, right? I mean, I think we all came into the season thinking that Minnesota is a lot better than it's shown through these two games. Now, it's not as good as we thought, but it probably is better than it's shown. And it's got to win this game in order to have some life in this season. If it goes 0-3 with the schedule that's upcoming, I think you legitimately start talking about it as a contender for bottom five. And the fans are going to start talking about the draft instead of the season. There's a ton at stake for Minnesota this weekend, more frankly than is at stake for the Titans in a non-conference game, right? That's where things could go awry for the Titans. Not because they're overlooking this game and thinking about anything else. I don't buy that. We're not into jinxes and mental stupidity. This is a a smart, disciplined football team that's well coached. They're not waltzing into Minnesota thinking about Minnesota, by the way. Wisconsin is a city in Minnesota, another city, according to Jayon Brown. This was revealed by Will Compton. Some really good geography in the Titans locker room. They should win this game, unquestionably. What's the spread? Wrinkle your newspaper and tell us the spread, Chad Withrow.
Titans are favored by, last time I saw, 1.5 is the way it opened.
That,
so,
to me.
I mean, look, Minnesota,
checked this morning and it was still 1.5. It had not moved.
Minnesota can't be much worse. They have averaged through 2 weeks just over 20 minutes time of possession. They have, of their 20 possessions, 12 of their 20 possessions have been 5 plays or less. They have the fewest run plays in the NFL because they're trailing. They are not good. They don't have anything in rhythm now. And there's no reason to give them an inch of rhythm on Sunday.
Yeah, that spread is about what Vegas thinks about the Titans defense, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And I think the Titans defense should be feeling like, hey, this is a game that gets us on track. I think the Titans absolutely should score in this game. The question is, does Kirk Cousins get on track in this game? And he absolutely shouldn't.
John Burton last night on Five asked me what I thought about how they get this third down defense fixed. And in thinking about it, like, it's not like I see the Titans with a lot of missed tackles. Cosell mentioned Byard would like one back, but it's not like that's the issue. It's like they're just whiffing. I can't point to missed tackles. And I don't think that teams are attacking one specific player and just targeting one specific weakness of a Titans defense. It's a combination of things. Like,
I've got the answer.
It's a group effort in what they have to do.
Well, I've got the answer. It's really first and second down. They're not doing enough on first and second down.
Did you see the third? They converted 5 third downs of 3rd and 7 or longer last Sunday.
Yeah, but they also they were in some 3rd and favorables as well. Give them the 3rd and 7s, but take away
that's a huge chunk of the 70% that are converted.
Yeah, a big chunk, but take away the 3rd and shorts, and that number still comes down substantially, right? So start with the 3rd and shorts.
Well, they're successful with both right now.
Right. Successful with both. But take away the 3rd and shorts, stop the 3rd and shorts, and the number comes down. And then if they're converting 3rd and 7s, you kind of tip your hat to the 3rd and 7s. The Titans convert those too, right? They got out of the 2nd and 20, which is a miracle. Vrabel said he was ready to punt when they were on 2nd and 20. You know, he said, I don't know how the hell we convert that. I was ready to punt. I agree with you, Hutt. I mean, they converted some good 3rd downs. But take away the easy 3rd downs first. And Vrabel was saying that we got to just do better earlier and start there. And I think if you start there, then if they're converting some 3rd and 7s, you know, against this secondary, I think it's going to happen. You really, really hope that next week Adoree Jackson's back. That is not a certainty from what I hear. I don't think they know what Adoree Jackson's state is, though. I think from what I'm hearing, that's a good sign that it's not long-term. Might be back after 3, suggests to me, you know, you're talking at most 4 or 5. It's not going to be longer than that.
I know we like to make proclamations on Friday on this show, but let me make a proclamation about this game right now. And I've talked about this from the Minnesota angle throughout the week. I know it's only week 3. I get that. We like to say that you'll know on this show. We'll know what Minnesota is on Sunday. Hutton's right. This is an empty the barrel type game. They are going to show if they're one of the worst teams in the league and go to 0-3 and get killed again, and this time by the Titans, or they're going to come out and win and show that they're going to be a respectable team moving forward. I'll say this about the Titans also. We'll know if they're an AFC championship contender on Sunday, because AFC championship contenders come out and destroy a team. Similar to what the Colts did,
like,
in bouncing back from the loss to Jacksonville.
You feel like they need to stomp them in order for you to know?
No, I don't feel that way. But I think this is a game that a team that is truly elite moving forward. And I'm not saying that a loss says they won't be elite as the season goes on. But I do think that this is a game where you stomp a team even when they try to fight back and have some relevance to their season. This is where a team that could be an AFC championship contender comes out and suffocates the life out of a team like Minnesota and goes to 3-0. So I think we'll know in both respects on Sunday about both teams, or it's going to be another season where the Titans could find themselves in a dogfight either for the division or for a playoff spot moving forward. Minnesota goes to 1-2 at the end of the week, and maybe they get back in the NFC North hunt and get up there with a team like Chicago and Green Bay now that have started 2-0. So I think this will say a lot about both teams on Sunday.
This is the kind of game that can help make AFC record and those kind of things as tiebreakers irrelevant, because if you have a better record by a game, you don't have to go to those tiebreakers, right? Pittsburgh and Buffalo are coming next. Be a game ahead of Houston and the Colts. You have 11 wins. They have 10 wins. You don't have to get into AFC wins because you beat a team like Minnesota.
Well, and the way it's positioned right now, you have Jacksonville playing on a short week right now at home against Miami. We know the gauntlet that Houston's facing. They're facing the Steelers on Sunday afternoon, and the Colts are hosting the Jets, but the Colts are 1-1. Titans have a chance to start 3-0. The Texans could fall to 0-3. The Colts at best will be 2-1, and so could Jacksonville. Jacksonville could also be 1-2 after tonight.
If you're three games ahead of Houston, I mean, that's a hell of a long – the Titans have been on the other side of that. We know how long a voyage that is to get back, right? It'd be awfully nice to be on the other side of that.
Stephen Godfrey is on the other side of this short commercial break. He has already joined us in the Zoom chat.
He's really
always
struggling.
Great whenever our guests arrive early.
I'm trying to figure out why everyone wants Atlanta to hire Arthur Smith. Maybe you guys can educate me on that.
It looks like you're the next coach, or you're the analyst based on the shirt you're wearing right now.
And is that a scarf or a mask that you're wearing around your
gator? Gator, come on.
But is it a bandana pattern?
No, it's just a...
He's a Falcons analyst and a poet.
You look like a combo, right. Yes, NFL coach, and also like you're going to recite me a haiku.
Anthony
Freeze wrote in a Brooklyn coffee shop.
Godfrey in rhyme. Next.
I love being on this show.
Queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone.
It's week 3, and the Titans find themselves in the Twin Cities for a showdown against Kirk Cousins and the Minnesota Vikings. Mike Keith and Coach Dave McGinnis have the call. Kickoff is Sunday at noon on your home for Titans football. 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, and each Thursday, Stephen Godfrey. Godfrey from Banner Society on the show with us. Time to talk some college football. And Chad, as you like to say, but Twitter won't let you spell, it is college football on Adderall.
It's crazy. Every time I try to spell out college football on Adderall with Stephen Godfrey, it corrects it to college football on address. With Stephen Godfrey. We can confirm this is college football on Adderall.
Are you guys doing the remote tomorrow?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. It's really close to where I live, and I might just show up and eat all the food.
Come eat. I'll buy you lunch.
Are you upset that you're not on tomorrow and you're on today? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, a little bit. I'm enough a part of the show now to just show up and tell those people, I'm good. I'm going to need 3 plates.
You do know that if you show up, because there's plenty to discuss with college football this weekend, and if we have an open segment, that you can't hop on with us also, and we can continue this discussion because we have a lot to get to in a short amount of time today.
That way Paul can make fun of the face protection I'm using to not get COVID, right?
Right, yes.
He can make fact criticism.
It looks – it the print on it makes it appear like you've got a bandana on your neck and you're currently inside your own home, I believe, where face protection is unnecessary. So you could remove the gator if you wanted.
Oh my God.
We're sitting here with Stephen Picasso on the show.
We're expecting poetry.
As I joked, we've got Teddy Roosevelt in the Amazon with us right now, also known as Stephen Godfrey. We're going to have to send a picture out so people know what we're talking about. This is Theater of the Mind.
Yes.
So we're describing what Godfrey looks like right now, but we'll also have an accompanying photo.
Put a beekeeper's helmet on. Sit back so I can get a better picture. Sit back.
I feel like this is the scene from Superbad where they're just going off on the guy's shirt and saying over and over, you look like Aladdin.
Ted's already our clown.
Put
we already
back have down one clown. And lower those fingers. That's inappropriate.
Now we're inappropriate.
Yes.
So Godfrey, I'm doing my requisite morning reading, going through some different sites, including yours, Banner Society, but also go to The Athletic, and I'm reading a piece about KJ Costello going to Mississippi State to play for Mike Leach.
Yeah.
And a quote that I read jumped out to me. I said, this is a Godfrey-level quote. I have to read this to you and get your response. This from KJ Costello comparing Pac-12 to the SEC. I'm going to keep it simple. There's no doubt that it, quote, means more. I can tell from how these guys practice. It's their life. It's their potential future. It's how they plan to take care of their families. You can see it in their face. You can see it in the way they train. You don't see that every day from every player in the Pac-12. This may strike some as a startling lack of perspective, but for people from the South that follow the SEC, it also rings true. What are your thoughts on that statement about his experience at Stanford in the Pac-12 and now at Mississippi State?
Yeah, but I mean, look, that's a pretty extreme transition, right? To go from Palo Alto, California, which is, you know, the tech hub of the world and one of the hardest universities to be accepted to in America. It's actually easier to get into some Ivy League schools. So to go from that environment to Starkville, Mississippi, like, yeah, you know, one might experience a little bit of a, how would you say it, cultural shift. I want to make a bunch of payroll jokes, but I won't. But yeah, I mean, I don't, that doesn't shock me at all. It shocks me that he was that open about it, because a lot of people who have ever been affiliated with the Pac-12 feel the need to just defend it, you know, without rest.
Well, and so that jumped out to me. Another thing that did was, and let's carry this into the Mississippi State LSU game, the first CBS game of the year for the SEC. He was talking about the experience at Stanford from a football perspective. He said it was a daily football school, that it was amazing how difficult that playbook was to learn, that Bill Walsh-inspired system of David Shaw, and how much they learn at Stanford. And then he said with Mike Leach, people would watch and think, oh, this is difficult to learn. He said it's the easiest playbook he's ever seen. And most people that go from high school to a Mike Leach system say it's the easiest thing that you're ever going to see when you look at his playbook. That may surprise some, but Godfrey, I'm sure in the coaches you talk to, you know that to be true about Leach and his air raid.
Yeah, no, the air raid is designed basically on visual learning, which is, you know, I mean, if you talk to any educator, it's funny, man, I write a lot more about educational psychology in college football than I ever thought I would, but it's visual descriptions. It's going through and actually physically walking the kid through. It's not about handing them a playbook. It's not so much about watching film. I'm not saying they don't watch film, but what I'm saying is they go out on the field, they break the field down into like squares more or less, and they zone off a lot of the more kind of complicated aspects and some of the verbiage that you guys hear on Saturdays and Sundays that feels like it's a different language. They break all that down into almost like very simple geometry, right? So the field is cut into thirds or it's cut into halves, depending on what the route tree is. And because of all this, it makes it quicker and quicker and faster to pick up for new personnel. Now, all that being said, the trick of this offense is to have the right personnel, and they probably don't have it right now. So I'm not expecting them to come out and look well-oiled on Saturday.
What do you think about Auburn and Kentucky when you look at that matchup? Yeah. And we can spin this into the SEC withholding information on whether or not the players that are transferring can play, because Joey Gatewood at Kentucky would factor in to be the starting quarterback, the transfer from Auburn. But he, like Cade Mays, like the player at Ole Miss, they've yet to hear from the SEC office. But without Joey Gatewood, what do you think about Kentucky and Auburn?
It's still probably the best game in the conference of the week, because they did this really bizarre. It's almost like they tried to replicate that opening weekend where a lot of these programs just get the cupcake gang out of the way, like, you know, to get warmed up. I truly believe this. I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. The league went about protecting its national title assets in a year of total uncertainty by trying to establish some normalcy. Okay. So Auburn, Kentucky ends up being the most compelling game of the week, not particularly because of like inequality of those two teams. It's just because the other games are so bad. Now, I will say they have differentiating styles, so that's interesting to me. You know, Kentucky's going to be way more physical and they're going to try and slow it down. But I mean, the bottom line is Auburn should be more talented than them at every key position.
You look at that cupcake element to the schedule, and you're right, Godfrey. But the two best games, Kentucky, Auburn, Tennessee, South Carolina. What does it say about those four teams? and the conference's view of those four teams to basically say, you guys are good, but not yet great. Yeah. So we want you to face off against each other in week one.
Well, that Tennessee-South Carolina game has been such a swing for either program the last couple of years. You know, really, you are not considered to be on the right path at Tennessee at any point in time if you're losing to South Carolina, right? We have discussed ad nauseum over this long offseason the kind of start that Tennessee has had as a program. I think it's very difficult for them. I wrote a piece this week basically asking an open question to the industry saying, we're not going to do the crazy hiring this year, right? So, like, South Carolina has a $58 million projected deficit in their budget. It costs right now about $13 million to buy out Will Muschamp. It would be probably in the neighborhood of $3.5 to $4 million a year for the next coach. So someone like Billy Napier, right? No one can afford to do that. I mean, you can never really afford to do it, but no one would take on that PR nightmare. So this leads me to a point. Maybe we see a South Carolina team with nothing to lose. And there's actually been a private assurance to coaches like Will Muschamp or Justin Fuente at Virginia Tech or Dave Dorn at NC State, where you're not on the hot seat because we cannot afford to fire you. Does that open up a program like South Carolina, who is very, very tight, very inefficient, to calm down, trust the system, and not worry as much?
So much like players in the NCAA this year get a mulligan, basically. Eligibility doesn't count. If they want it to be that way, they can do that. You could see a scenario where it's a coaching mulligan for every team in major college football as well.
I would have a really, really hard time looking at public schools specifically who are operating on massive budget deficits projected by, I mean, these are their own people saying, we're going to be $50 million short. We're going to be $60 million short. To then go to their private foundations and say, I need you to eat a $10 or $12 million buyout while we get together a contract for the next guy. Now, the one exception in this is USC. So if the Pac-12 comes back, that's a private institution. And at no point in time in the modern history of this sport has USC really followed suit. They've never done what people predict them to do. So if there was a high, high level job that opened this year in COVID, I think it might be USC still. The other ones, though, the South Carolinas of the world, I think they have to stand with their personnel right now. I just don't see how they could afford to move.
Stephen Godfrey with us on the Midday 180.
How thrilled is Vanderbilt to know that that's the case in college football, that they're not going to have to make a decision on Derek Mason after this season, and he's going to get another year, probably two more years after this, regardless, and they won't be having to pay any type of buyout?
I don't think, Chad, I really don't think they were going to fire him this year going into COVID. I really don't. I think that they are. I think with everything that's going on behind the scenes, this is, again, something we've talked about a lot. I think Vanderbilt wants to put itself in a better position to evaluate the football program start to finish. And I think there would be a lot of anxiety at Vanderbilt about making a head coaching hire for the next 4 or 5 years without understanding exactly what the identity of the program is going to be financially, what they're going to do about recruiting. I mean, they are in the process of an audit, and it does not make sense to push Derek Mason out yet.
You look at the opt-outs, you look at the transfers, and these are guys who are going to play, and in some cases starters. But you look at everything going on with that program, and look, Derek Mason is behind the eight ball to begin with at Vanderbilt, and now he's got less than a full deck, and it looks like 0-10. I mean, I think winning one game is a huge success for Vanderbilt this year. It certainly looks like 0-10 this season. But given all those factors, does he deserve any blame here? Is there any type of judgment to be passed on Derek Mason? It's so difficult, Godfrey, to know how to rate this program and how to rate the job Derek Mason is doing based on all these factors. Does he deserve some of the blame for players opting out, for instance, or players transferring? It's so difficult to know how to even rate the job that he's doing, especially this year.
I would caution against anybody trying to ascribe blame.
But by the way, we have no problem judging Jeremy Pruitt this year, right? I mean, it's different for every program and every coach, even with COVID-19.
We judge the reaction, just to be very specific and granular for a second. There's going to be a stronger reaction to Jeremy Pruitt this year because Tennessee has a much more fervent and passionate fan base. It's a more expensive job. It's a more valuable job, okay? My recommendation is that no one try and put context on what's about to happen in the SEC. This is a completely unique year. I would strongly suggest, I don't know if you can see me saying this,
strongly suggest that SEC fans get ready for delays, get ready for rescheduling, get ready for the problems that we've already seen in September at these other conferences. Because of all this, I don't think it's fair to build context on the 2020 season. I mean, as for Vanderbilt, what he's I don't think anyone should be responsible for an opt-out. We're in a completely unique time frame. We've never seen anything like this. So I would not blame a coach for having opt-outs on his team. I would not congratulate a coach for not having opt-outs on his team. Transfers are a different issue. If you want to blame Derek Mason for something, they've had offensive identity crisis since day one. I mean, even when they had good coordinators, it didn't really translate. They lost a coordinator to another P5 program who was then more successful when he left. There is a fundamental issue with offensive football at Vanderbilt. Again, this has nothing to do with COVID. So I would caution against anybody making a broad sweeping judgment on their program in 2020.
Well, and the quarterback carousel that we have come to live and expect at Vandy will continue this year. I mean, that's clear. We're going to see that the short leash on one guy moving to the next. And then, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to why a player is going in or not, good or bad, as we've seen in the past. And with four quarterbacks right now and not really knowing who's going to be the guy, chances are we'll see two or three of them Saturday against Texas A&M.
I would play that out across the SEC almost, because what I'm not seeing right now in my colleagues' coverage, in radio, just in the conversation in general, is that no one seems to be applying what's going on at other programs to the SEC. I think there's this weird belief that we've all been coached into that the SEC is somehow going to be immune to roster issues, to losing entire position groups, to delaying and rescheduling games. The deepest team wins this year. That's it. It's the deepest team. It will be an ugly year in terms of football schematically, but the deepest team is going to win, and it's not going to be pretty.
I'm a bit surprised that the testing is taking place on Fridays. Travel day. And you would think as a coach, as a program, you want at least an extra 24 hours to adjust to a positive test or to, you know, your contact tracing, which will take place, right? So if you pop for a positive on a Friday and you have a kickoff on Saturday at noon or 11 a.m., that's not conducive to winning football or adjusting to a backup that can come in and actually help you.
The reason why they're conducting tests on Friday, and they probably won't admit this publicly, is it's all CYA. Because if there are positives on Monday or Tuesday the following week, and there's negatives for the same individual on Friday, what does that tell you?
Oh, that they got through the game.
They got it from the game. So the thing to watch right now in all of college football that nobody's talking about is, did Notre Dame give you USF coronavirus? They might have. The way that testing lines up, right now we don't know why exactly when the breakout that caused USF to delay their game this week happened. Did that happen on the field? We need to know that. So that's why those Friday tests are occurring.
So it's a combination of CYA and pass the buck.
Correct. That's exactly right, Paul.
I still don't understand.
Is anybody calling that out and saying they don't like it, or are people all falling in line with that?
Not liking the Friday tests?
Yeah.
Coaches hate it because of what Hutton was talking about, right? So the immediate curveball that you get thrown on possibly a Saturday morning on changing out personnel, obviously no coach would enjoy that. It has to be done for a variety of reasons, like we talked about. Again, they're trying to establish patterns. They're trying to trace. They're also trying to show consistency. That's another thing. The thing I find really interesting is a lot of these non-conference matchups where you've had FCS teams going to, you know, ACC schools, and then the next week the same FCS team, maybe they go to a Conference USA school, the frequency and the specific testing is totally different. So everything's done by conference. So there's a lot of incongruent right. Things going on in terms of, this school was here last week. They tested three times going to play the Big 12. Now they're going to play another FCS team. They're only going to test once. This is what I've been told. And then the following week, maybe they go play a G5 school where they have to test different. It's saliva. It's not nasal.
and they're going to do it on Monday and Thursday instead of Monday, Wednesday, Friday. None of this has caught up with us yet, but the first red flag I've seen was this Notre Dame-USF thing.
But it should not catch up with the SEC if every school – I mean, that's why you want to play your conference-only schedule. Yeah. Yeah. Is your opponent is under the same exact protocols that you're under based on conference guidelines. But that goes back to my testing question. I don't understand why the SEC isn't testing more for that reason, because it's conference only and because they're the dominant conference with the millions upon millions of dollars. They've got the financial resources to test more. I don't understand why they don't.
It's a really good question, Hutton.
Well, and it's not only that, but with the SEC, and I think why people are a little bit more confident in this, the way they structured the off weeks, right? If you had a first half of the season cancellation, there is flexibility to move a game mm-hmm. with teams have the same bye week, but also the ability to flip-flop on the fly, right? One team has a COVID-19 outbreak. Another team has a COVID-19 outbreak. They have two different opponents. Instead of canceling two games, they add those two opponents together that are clean at that point. For that week. I mean, that is something that could happen this year, right?
Chad, hypothetically, Jeremy Pruitt and Tennessee are in the process of preparing for Alabama or Georgia. And all of a sudden, that situation that you just described happens. And now, with a 3 or 4 day notice, you're preparing for Mike Leach in Mississippi State. You're preparing for Lane Kiffin. Yeah. You're preparing for Ed Orgeron.
But this goes back to your point in your column, though, that none of that matters this year.
It should.
They're trying to get games in, but in terms of outcome, yeah, that sucks for those schools that have to change and prepare for a completely different system on the fly.
Yeah.
But that with the fans, it's going to matter. We all know that. The fans are going to be angry. You know, we're going to take calls on Monday if Tennessee gets blown out by South Carolina from angry Tennessee fans. None of that's going to change. But if Philip Fulmer is telling Jeremy Pruitt, go out there and win as many games as you can and navigate this as best you can, you're fine. And if Will Muschamp's hearing the same thing at South Carolina and any other coach who, and I'm not saying Jeremy Pruitt's on the hot seat, but coaches even on the hot seat are being told that, then what does it really matter?
The question I have is I don't know whether or not these hot seat coaches are being told that. And what I'm already feeling is, you know, we're in this insane rush to get back to normal in all aspects of life right now. And normal is not possible. It may actually be harmful in a lot of ways. One of those rushes to get back to normal that I've witnessed is booster culture. It's the fandom. It extends all the way into folks who call into your show, all the way to major power brokers at universities who write those buyout checks. The best and most responsible way to consume this SEC stuff this year is to go in exactly like you said, understand this is an asterisk. Tennessee could finish 6-4 or 4-6 or 2-8 or 8-2. And we will not really understand the context of that. So do not build large scale narratives off of what happens in football this year. It is not responsible to do it.
Stephen Godfrey, Banner Society. Follow him on Twitter at 38 Godfrey. Appreciate you, man. Always great to have you on the show. And can't wait for next week when we recap what we saw on Saturday when the SEC kicks off.
Next time, add a pipe to this look, I think.
I'm wearing a scarf. I'm going to go find an ascot.
And yes.
Just for
that's Paul. Your look.
Just right. For all right. Of his watercolor paintings can be in the background as well.
We're getting everything in.
All right.
Perfect.
Thank you, Godfrey.
See you tomorrow.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone.
104.5 The Zone actually hire a guy who protected Ben Roethlisberger for 11 years? Yeah, that happened. But hey, he's still a Vol for life. Get J-Mart and Ramon Foster tomorrow morning from 6 to 9 on 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, and some good news from Will and Catherine Newman. Just got a text. Poncho and Lefty's downtown. Their downtown location right there on 5th Avenue at 104 5th Avenue. Just think 104.5. It's opening back up today at 4 o'clock.
Excellent.
They are back open at their Fifth Avenue location overlooking Bridgestone Arena. Rooftop margaritas and the tacos, they are back downtown. Ponchoandlefties.com for more information. Edley'sBBQ.com for delivery options and great menu options for their three locations for great barbecue. 12 Southeast Nashville, Sylvan Park. Crew's all here except for David Reed. Reed was in a car accident this morning and was taken to the emergency room. He is okay right now. Latest update is they're running some more tests, but all of the, for those that have followed the show, you're a season ticket holder, all of the back, the spinal fusions and all of the hardware in his back and on his spine are structurally sound. That was the biggest concern in this. Apparently someone ran a red light and hit him. And so far it's as good as it can be. With the early indications are right now he's in a ton of pain, but that's it. They're running more tests, but so far so good. So we're thrilled with that text that we had during the break.
Excellent news to this point. Yes. And hopefully the pain has been significantly reduced for him as well.
So do you guys buy what Godfrey is saying about you can't put any context into this season for the SEC with any team? Because I disagree with him on this front. I think you can put context from week to week. I think there will be certain moments in the season that you just have to throw out and say they were at a clear disadvantage, right? And it's not even about excuse making. It's just saying the truth. If a team is without four or five star players against a really good opponent, they lose by 50.
Full strength versus full strength.
It's right to go and criticize.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if Tennessee and South Carolina both have a full complement of players,
especially the coaching, they're getting paid millions.
From a coaching perspective, then we can talk about it.
Sure.
They paid millions. So, yeah, I mean, it goes back to the overall theme of how you lose, right? And all of the circumstances surrounding this season factor into that. But they've had plenty of time to get ready for the season. It's not like there was this rush to get back in gear and all of a sudden, okay, it's time for kickoff.
Yeah, I agree entirely.
I do buy his idea that there's a bit of a mulligan from athletic directors to their coaches this year. They're not going to want, especially at state schools, because of everything financially going on, they're not going to want to be paying buyouts.
Yeah,
so I agree with that, you're probably safe even if you have a miserable season, and that's going to be fine. Here's the other part of this too. A school like Tennessee, they need to keep this recruiting class together. They've got a top five national recruiting class right now. Well, the thought going into a normal season is, if you struggle and look bad on the field, then you're going to lose recruits. I wonder how much hedging there is going on with these tests. They're always going to try to sell anything positive they can, regardless. But will high school recruits cut some slack to teams that they've been committed to if they don't perform as well as they expected them to this season? Because that's the knock. That would be the knock with Tennessee. Oh, you got blown out by Florida, Georgia, Alabama, everyone good on your schedule again. You go 3-7. If you're Tennessee, I'm out. You
know, part of the recruiting pitch, right?
I'm going to go to someone that wins now. Well, I wonder how many recruits are going to be sold and buy from the coaches this year doesn't count. This year is very weird. We had this many guys out. It's been a very strange offseason. It was strange getting ready for the season with all these guys out. Every program's going to – and look, if you're winning, you're just going to sell that you're winning, right? You're going to leave that part of it out, even if other teams have a lot of guys out. To me, that's what's fascinating about – you want to get through this season. We're all excited to watch SEC football on Saturday. But bridging the gap from 2020 to 2021 and what that looks like and what 2020, what type of impact does it have on the future of the program? And is there any long-term impact with what we see on the field this year? I'm not talking about testing and everything else and games being postponed or canceled. I'm talking about what 2020 looks like from a record standpoint, from an on-field performance standpoint, and how that affects a coach, a head coach, coaching staff, and roster moving forward. And is there any long-term impact?
I think that's
something we're going to have to follow all year and see week to week what that looks like with decommitments and what's going on within programs.
I think on the recruiting front, every coach is going to tell you, like, hey, I've always got something I've got to hold up there as my big selling point. I've always got something I've got to soften and downplay and explain. And this is just like that. It gives me more maybe of that, but I've got to do the same thing I've done before. If I've got a COVID thing I need to explain, I got to explain it better. And if I've got success, I've got to sell it better. right? Same as always.
In 20 minutes, Titans left tackle Taylor Lewan will join us. When we come back, we'll listen in to Titans head coach Mike Vrabel with the media here on the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone.
Listen to The Zone anytime, anywhere. Plus, have your favorite Zone podcasts all in one place. Download the 104.5 The Zone app and take The Zone with you wherever you go.